Kill them.
Kill them both. We're missing Antiques Roadshow.
We're interrupting this program to bring you the most exciting piece of news that's happened since the war.
Like magic, an invisible chain of sound once more circles the planet.
Anything can happen in the next hour.
Who else has electricity streaming from his eyeballs and from his fingers?
Can you dig it? Can you dig it?
Talking about cause and effect in the outside world. We're not living in the outside world.
You know, it's a pity you weren't born a girl.
Yes, I've always envied you that.
Welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast.
Paleo Cinema Podcast looks at movies between 1895 and 1990. We cover all mainstream and genre films, books, TV, and whatever else Terry gets obsessed about. The email address is cultguru@gmail.com. That's cultguru@gmail.com. The new voicemail number is 206-350-5440, or you can leave messages on Skype at Paleo Cinema, all lowercase and no dash. This podcast may include swearing and adult content, so if you hear anything you don't understand, just fucking Google it.
Hello and welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast number 64. My name is Terry Frost, and this time in the rodeo, we're looking at a spy movie. Always liked my spy movies, and also a very good British drama from 1957. So what's been happening? It's been raining a hell of a lot here in Melbourne. People are starting to believe in the global warming thing, mostly because they're seeing more extreme weather events. So we had a lot of rain. Victoria's had a lot of flooding. New South Wales has had a lot of flooding. South Australia's had a lot of flooding. And things are even weird up in the Northern Territory, where I do that radio gig once a week. Yep, I'm still doing the radio gig. I did it last week, and I talked about Forbidden Planet in commemoration of Leslie Nielsen stepping on a rainbow. So I enjoyed that. That was a lot of fun to do. And this week, I kind of crossed paths but didn't quite hook up with the guy who was doing it, a fellow named Paul, so we didn't quite get it going this week. Hopefully next week it'll be on again, and I'm going to do a little examination of the first of the James Bond movies. Doctor No, not the first James Bond on the screen, because the first James Bond on the screen was Barry Nelson in 1954 in an episode of Climax, but we'll leave that alone. I'm looking at doing Doctor No next time around, so just kind of going back to the beginning of the Bond phenomenon. I am enjoying it. It's a little fun. It's different from what I'm currently doing with a podcast. Apart from anything else, I'm talking to somebody else in it. And again, 2011 is the year I'm going to get that shit together. And it's great. I really do appreciate the feedback I get from the presenters, and it has been positive, so that's all good. Apart from that, been watching some movies, doing all the holiday shopping and things like that. Of course, we all know now that I celebrate Newton Mass, which is the birthday of Isaac Newton on the 25th of December, and we give gifts of knowledge, so books, DVDs, thumb drives, anything at all to do with knowledge stuff. It's an atheist kind of thing. We'd rather give truth than comforting fiction. And of course, those people who among you who are religious, I apologize for that if it offends you, but I don't apologize for believing what I believe. Anyway, let's roll right along. What have I been watching? Just after I did the last podcast, I kind of vegged out. I went down to JB Hi-Fi and picked up the whole five of the original Planet of the Apes movies, not the Tim Burton thing, but the original ones with Charlton Heston and Roddy McDowall and all those guys. And I watched them in a sitting on the Sunday, because I did the podcast on the Saturday, and on the Sunday I went totally monkey mad and watched all of the Planet of the Apes movies. Yeah, they are fun to watch. I really think it's a weird thing when a movie is an incredible success the way Planet of the Apes was, and yet the studio decreased the budgets with each sequel. That's kind of contrary to what we have now, where if something's incredibly successful, they throw money at each sequel until they become unsuccessful, and then they go, oh, no, sorry, it's too much for us. But they did it the other way around. They got five movies out of it. And there is an interesting story arc there. I think it was maybe watered down for a few reasons, one of which is, of course, the decreasing budgets and the fact that even though... Well, let me rephrase that. These days, I think the good genre films, particularly in science fiction and fantasy areas, are the ones that treat the source material seriously. I'm not sure that the studio and the people making Planet of the Apes really treated the source material with respect. I mean, yes, it's an absurd concept, but you've got to have that certain regard for what you're doing. And as the movies increased, I think apart from maybe the creatives involved, the studios and the background people really didn't give it the same love that they would on a successful franchise of the 21st century. But, yeah, I didn't hate any of them. And I did enjoy them all a fair bit. Now, I have been watching some other things as well. I saw The Left Hand of God, a 1955 movie starring Humphrey Bogart and Gene Tierney. Lee J. Cobb's in it, E.G. Marshall. Agnes Moorehead's in it as well. Basically, it's the story of a priest that wanders into a Chinese village just before the Cultural Revolution hit. And he's a replacement for a priest who died. And he gets involved with a local warlord, played by Lee J. Cobb, with little half epicanthic folds over his eyes. And it turns out that he's not a priest and he's got a different story arc to that. And so it's okay for Gene Tierney to fall in love with him. It's not a bad little studio pick for the 50s, and it's nice to see Bogart kind of pretending to be a priest, even though the subtext is that the guy's an atheist. He's got respect for the religious people, but he's really not playing in their paddock. And yeah, it is a little bit of a fun, and it's not to be played terribly seriously, but not bad at all. Recommend that one. I did catch an English TV series. It's on the second season now. It's called Misfits. It's about a bunch of kids who are kind of doing community service for various minor crimes, who get struck by lightning and get various superpowers. It is quite good. The language is raw and rough. The concepts are raw and rough. It's very gritty. And, even though the characters aren't particularly likable, it does suck you in. And I did enjoy that a fair bit. Watched all of season one. This is a British TV series, of course, so the seasons run about 6-7 episodes in this case. And I'm kind of halfway through season two, catching up to where it's being broadcast in the UK. And, if you get a chance to find a copy of it, it's not going to be a waste of your time or your money. I did pick up some Blu-rays as well. I picked up the Blu-rays and watched the Blu-rays of the Russian fantasy films Night Watch and Day Watch. Nochnoi Dozor and Dvezhna Dozor. How's that? The original Blu-rays I got, I picked up the US US DVD, when it first came out of Night Watch. And I got the Australian one of Day Watch when it came out. The interesting thing about the Blu-ray versions is that there's a lot of more footage in there, and the stories are more complete, and you get a better understanding of things. I've also read the novels upon which the two movies are based, and the novels have got their own direction that they take away from the arc of the movie, and that's fine too. In the later books, in fact, the author acknowledges that there's another history just lying beyond a certain barrier where things play out differently. But Night Watch and Day Watch, if you're going to see them, try to get the Blu-ray edition. I picked up the local Australian one, but there's got to be a decent one. Make sure you've got a very long play time on it, because the extra footage is not padding. It's not wasted. It does have a couple of story arcs which just aren't in the DVD copies that I got. And they do play out really well and feed into the main storyline and make some other bits and pieces that you might see in the shorter one make a bit more sense. So I'd recommend them. I have seen a few other things, but nothing really that jumps out at me. And I am quite fond of Night Watch and Day Watch. Very good films. And I like seeing fantasy films from other cultures. I mean, apart from Western, you know, English, American, Australian culture, I like seeing things from other cultures. And Night Watch and Day Watch are definitely worth that. So, on to the show. I'm going to take a little bit of a break now and play the only bit of Christmas music you are going to hear on this podcast this year around, and then get stuck into the first of the two movies, The Kremlin Letter from 1970, starring Patrick O'Neill, Richard Boone, one of our great favourites here at Paleo Cinema, and directed by John Huston.
Santa can keep the hi-fi set. There's something that is better yet. I want, ooh, your Christmas kisses. Lots of nice presents, they're all right. But baby, they can't hold me tight. I want, ooh, your Christmas kisses.
Your Christmas kisses.
Wrap them up pretty one by one. Two by two, three by three. Then when you got the wrapping done, give them all to me. After the mistletoe is hung, the tree is trimmed, the carol sung. I want, ooh, ooh, your Christmas kisses.
Your Christmas kisses.
Then when you've got the wrapping done, give them all to me. After the mistletoe is hung, the tree is trimmed, the carol sung. I want, ooh, ooh, I want, ooh, ooh, I want, ooh, ooh, your Christmas kisses, your Christmas kisses, your Christmas kisses.
There you go, a little bit of saccharin for your coffee. That was Ray Anthony and Christmas Kisses. Enough said. Let's get on to the first of the two films, The Kremlin Letter. I think this is an incredibly underrated spy movie from 1970. It kind of came at the tail end of that big spy craze of the 1960s, and it doesn't have a lot in common with, say, the James Bond films or a lot of Euro spy movies, which have a light and slightly comedic touch. It's very hard to do a synopsis for this film because on Wikipedia there are 6 pages of synopsis for this film. It's a very dense political thriller. It's a hard one to do. Basically, it's about a team of aged intelligence agents working for the US who, 20 years after their heyday, get a young man called Charles Roan, played by Patrick O'Neill. Well, a younger man. Actually, O'Neill was 43 at the time, so he's playing younger than his age, in a sense. He's a naval officer, and he is coerced into, well, basically seduced with money, into travelling to Russia. He speaks Russian fluently, and he's a polymath, and he's got a photographic memory. He has all of these virtues that a secret agent would love to have. And he is involved in something called the Kremlin Letter, which is a letter which gives somebody secrets. It's basically a MacGuffin. You don't need to know that shit. You don't need to know what's in the Kremlin Letter. I can't even remember myself. But he gets involved in a honey trap with the wife of a Russian intelligence officer. He gets involved with being a conduit for intelligence to be brought out of Russia because he is in a recording device. He has a photographic memory, so they put a mask on him so nobody knows who he is, and the secret agents meet him in a room and give him information which he can then repeat verbatim once he's back across in friendly hands. In common with Hell Drivers, which I'm going to talk about in a moment, the cast in this film kicks incredible ass. I'll just give you a bit of a readout of the people who are in some way involved with this. John Huston himself, in fact, does a cameo at the start as a naval officer who is telling Charles Roan that he's basically chucked out of the Navy. Actually, I found a synopsis for this film. It's a brief one, but it may give a little bit of the flavour of it slightly better than I did a moment ago. A network of older spies from the West recruit a younger intelligence officer with a photographic memory to accompany them on a mission inside Russia. They must recover a letter written by a CIA agent that promises American assistance to Russia if China gets the atomic bomb. So that's basically it. Now, I'm going to go on and just tell you who's in this film. They're not always in it for a very long time, but the cast is extraordinarily kick-ass. You got Richard Boone playing Ward, and I'll play some audio of Richard Boone in a moment talking. He's fantastic in this film. It's one of his better later roles. You've got Dean Jagger. You've got Patrick O'Neill, of course. Barbara Parkins as BA, who's a cute, safe-cracking chick, the love interest. George Sanders playing Warlock, a transvestite homosexual spy. Ralph Fiennes in it. Max von Sydow playing Colonel Kosnoff, the intelligence agent whose wife Patrick O'Neill seduces. The wife is played by Bibi Anderson, the Scandinavian actress. Orson Welles is in it. Niall McGuinness playing a rector set. Niall McGuinness, you might remember from Night of the Demon / Curse of the Demon. He's in there. Vonetta McGee's in there briefly. It's got incredible things. And also, the other person I've got to mention is Nigel Green. Nigel Green, you might remember from any number of films. He's in Jason and the Argonauts. He played the main villain in the Ipcress file. He played the Electric Jesus in The Ruling Class. In fact, there's an audio grab from him in the intro of this podcast every time. And he plays a character called the Whore. And we first meet him in Mexico at his bordello that he runs. And he's there with kind of sun-bleached hair and he's shirtless and looking really good, watching his whores wrestle for money. So it's quite an interesting little bit there. And Nigel Green in this is quite funny. He's having a great time with it. Unfortunately, he died at an early age. It may have been an accidental overdose. It may not have been. But unfortunately, he's one of those people that was suffering from depression. But an actor that I always like seeing in whatever role he does. He's got a beautiful theatrical presence and quite an interesting voice. So just the cast alone is worth the film. Now, there are a few other interesting aspects to this. The way they handle foreign languages is really, really well done. I think they did a little bit of this similarly, but not quite as well, I believe, in The Hunt for Red October, where they phased into English after a while. What they do is they have the actors speak, in this case, Russian, and then they have, it's almost like their thoughts in English, so they have the actor then read the line in English. And they do this repeatedly back and forth between whoever's speaking. And the voiceovers are done closer and closer to the speaking in Russian and then slowly over the top of it. And then the actor speaks in English. So there's a kind of transition between the two languages, which is done fantastically well. It's a conceit, and yes, it's a little bit of a theatrical thing, but it really does work. And Houston plays it very, very well, and it's one of those little bits of a film that has taken some consideration and really makes itself a part of the feel of the film. A lot of it was filmed in Finland, in Helsinki, because it had the right look and it was cold and that, but it was also filmed in various other places around the world. So why do I like this film? Actually, I'll play some audio before I go into the why do I likes. Play a couple of audio grabs from it and get into it.
Lieutenant Commander Charles E. Rome, you are hereby informed that 1400 hours today, October 10th, 1969, you will no longer be under the jurisdiction of the Department of the Navy.
Excuse me, sir?
You are further informed that as of 1400 hours today, October 10th, 1969, your commission as an officer in the Navy of the United States will be suspended. And concurrent with said suspension, all rights and benefits accruing to you in the past are due to you in the future as either an officer in the naval establishment or a member of the armed forces of the United States will forthwith and forever be revoked and canceled. Not that it makes a goddamn bit of difference to you, I suppose.
But, sir, I...
You will no longer address me as sir.
Under what authority have I been separated?
I'm sure your new friends in Washington can explain.
What friends?
Your friends in CIA or CIC or ONI, how the hell would I know? I do know that a good many regular Army and Navy officers are damn sorry those bastard organizations ever came into existence. Why aren't you in civilian clothes? Only officers in the United States Navy are entitled to wear that uniform. Once upon a time, legend has it, some men even died for it. Dismissed, Mr. Rome.
That, of course, was John Huston giving Roan his marching orders. And it sets the tone for the film. This is a very harsh film. Now, I'm going to play a little bit of Richard Boone playing Ward, the handler of the CIA or whatever it is team. And Richard Boone is fantastic in this film.
Who was Raymond Hatfield?
Your predecessor, Scooter, had a real good memory. Want some coffee? I don't hold much with what folks call total recall, but I guess you and him come pretty close to having it. See, you're his backup man, his replacement. Sort of like football. Everybody on the first string got to have a substitute. Well, he up and died. Heart. So off the bench you come. Get the idea?
I think so.
Sorry to call you out so sudden-like, but old Scooter didn't give us much warning. Nephew Charlie. Now, you wouldn't take it unkindly if every now and again I was to offer you some little odds and ends of advice, would you?
Oh, no, not at all.
Well, my face is bothering you. It had a skin graft. Sure, a long time ago. One of those post-war retread jobs. It is not a thing of beauty. But if you are going to look at me, look at me. Don't check and recheck me the way you've been doing. Your file says you're as smart as they come. But smart don't matter a damn unless you're quick, too. You got to be both, see?
Yes.
Good. Good. Nephew, you ever read through that file of yours?
No.
Well, I don't recommend it. It might just turn your head. How many languages is it you speak without an accent? 7?
8.
Coolie. Only fault they can find with you is in the psychiatrist's report. They speculate about a death wish originating from your boyhood when you saw your mama and papa and brothers killed in a plane crash. What do you say to that, nephew?
I'd say that's a lot of rubbish.
I got a different idea about why you dove off that cliff in Acapulco and why you stuck your neck out so far in Korea. Nephew, they say that heroes can't imagine their own death, and that's why they're heroes. You go one better. You imagine you're immune to violence. Not only that, but you've taken the trouble to collect the proof. Now, which theory do you go with?
Neither one.
Neither one? Well, now, what do you think?
I think I'm a superior combination of intellect and physique, athlete and scholar. When a risk is to be run, I formulate the ideal procedure and calculate the chances involved with exquisite precision. If the percentages are sufficiently in my favor, I put myself into motion, having absolute confidence in the performance of my reflexes.
Nephew, the truth is you are full of yourself.
This is one of Richard Boone's best roles. He is charismatic, a good old boy, and a total psychopath as well. I'm not going to do any spoilers on the plot, but there are a couple of plot twists which are really unexpected, but within reason, and also incredibly brutal. There's not graphically violent, but there's a brutality to the rolling out of this story that's pretty extreme for its time and a little bit unexpected. And as I said, that ensemble cast really does make this incredibly vivid and fun. And I do recommend it. I'm surprised that this film doesn't have a better reputation than it does. It wasn't particularly successful at the time of release, maybe because people at the time maybe weren't ready for a densely plotted spy thriller. It came on the end of that kind of spy craze. 1970 was a little late for a lot of the spy things. People were moving into other genres as the flavor of the month kind of thing. And maybe if it had been made in 1965, it would have got a better reaction, but it was made in 69-70, and so kind of fell off the tail end of the genre. You can find it around through the usual suspects, and well worth checking out. Fantastically interesting film, and it's nice to see a whole ensemble of really cool actors. For instance, Orson Welles playing Brezhnevich, one of the spy chiefs and Russian spy chiefs, is having a great time with it. He's kind of cherubic and cheerful and ruthless at the same time. Max von Sydow is very, very good as the spy master Kozhnov. It's one of his earlier English language roles. And even though these days he's in a lot of things, it's interesting to see him as a younger man. But the standouts are really Nigel Green playing Lord Ashley's whore, otherwise known as the whore. He's fantastic. Patrick O'Neill's kind of good but not standout as Roan. George Sanders has his little fun bits. And I always like seeing Niall McGuinness in movies because I've got that immense fondness for him in Night of the Demon. And And that's one of the things I wanted to talk about. There are always actors who you have a lot of, let's just say, kind of goodwill towards. They've built up a lot of brownie points over their career with you, so that when they're on the screen, you feel that little kind of squee of happiness in your heart. And Niall McGuinness for me is one of those. There aren't any number of them. Nigel Green's another one. I always like watching Nigel Green in movies. He played Hercules in Jason and the Argonauts, and he was quite bombastic and fun in that. He wasn't rippling muscles the way Hercules's were in the Sword and Sandal, Pablo epics in the 1960s, but he kind of brings it across as a bragging demigod, which in essence Hercules was. But and this one, unfortunately, is a kind of forgotten spy movie. So check it out. I'm going to take a break now. Actually, after that last clip, there's been about a 15-hour hiatus. I went to a Christmas party that I realised I had to go to. And now I've come back the next morning to finish off the podcast. So if there's a little bit of a disjuncture between the way I sound then and the way I sound now, that's the reason why. I've actually had a good night's sleep and also about 6 hours of partying. So I'm going to take another break, and I'll get back and I'll start talking about Hell Drivers.
You don't know that I felt good when we up and parted.
You don't know I knocked on wood, gladly brokenhearted.
Pouring through, I sleep all night, appetite and health restored.
You don't know how much we're bored.
The sleepless nights, the daily fights, the quick to bargain when you reach the heights. I miss the kisses and I miss the fights. I wish I were in love again.
The broken dates, the endless waits, the lovely loving and the hateful hates, the conversation with the flying plates. I wish I were in love again.
No more pain,
no more strain.
Now I'm sane, but I would rather be Gaga, the pulled out fur of Captain Kerr,
the fine mismating of a him and her.
We've learned our lesson and we wish we were in love again. Furtive sigh, the blackened eye, the words I'll love you till the day I die, the self-deception that believes the lie. I wish I were in love again.
When love congeals, it soon reveals the faint aroma of performing seals, the double crossing of a pair of eels. I wish I were in love again. No more care,
no despair.
I'm all there now, but I'd rather be punch drunk.
Believe me, sir, I much prefer the classic battle of a him and her. We don't like quiet and we wish we were in love.
That was Mickey Rooney and Judy Garland singing I Wish I Were in Love Again from Words and Music, the kind of bowdlerized biography pick of Rodgers and Hart. I love that lyric, when love congeals, it soon reveals the faint aroma of performing seals. It's got to be one of the most ambiguous lyrics in movie history. Anyway, on to Hell Drivers. This is a 1957 British drama. It was directed by Cy Endfield, an American director who came over to the UK to escape the House Un-American Activities Committee in the early 1950s. It stars Stanley Baker, Herbert Long, Peggy Cummins, Patrick McGoohan, and Sean Connery. There are a number of other people in the cast as well, but I'll give you the plot synopsis first. It's the plot circles around Joe Tom Yateley, played by Stanley Baker, who's an ex-convict trying to leave his past behind. He decides to start working for Hawlett Trucking Company, which transports gravel. Trouble begins when he tries to expose his boss's rackets, which isn't really true. Basically, he doesn't want to expose the boss's rackets. He just wants to earn money so he can get a start after he's got out of jail. And Hawlett's, the haulage company, is an incredibly brutal company. they plays the truck drivers off against each other. There's a bonus system. But basically, I'll play the bit where Tom meets the guy running Hawlett's trucking company, a guy called Cartley, played by William Hartnell, who, as my friend Ian Mond, the circumcised newbie of podcasting, knows, was the first person to play Doctor Who. So I'll just play the little bit of dialogue as he's getting interviewed for the job, and it just gives you an idea of what kind of a place this is that that Tom finds himself working in.
Yes?
I heard you needed ballast drivers.
You met Lagubin, is that right?
Yeah.
Did he tell you how much he cost us in compensation? He couldn't handle the loads, not at the speeds we wanted. How long have you been driving?
12 years.
Many accidents?
No.
You sure?
No, look, I told you.
License. No endorsements, no convictions for speeding, why not?
I guess I was never caught.
Name and address of your last employer.
I've been out of the country.
Where?
Around.
I want fast drivers. 50 miles an hour tucks, right round the clock.
What kind of roads?
Bad roads, wet or fine.
What about the speed limit?
That's up to you. If you're caught, you pay your own fine. So if you don't think you can handle 10 tons at that speed, just say so.
What's the money?
We work a bonus system here. You get 7 shillings a load plus 4 shillings an hour.
Over what distances?
10 miles each way. 12 loads a day minimum. Anything under, you're fired.
It's a pretty rough pace, isn't it?
We've got one man that does 18 runs a day.
Well, what about breakdowns?
You maintain your own lorry at night. If you have a breakdown, it's your fault. And, we'd like you to keep your vehicle clean. There's a bonus each week for the best-looking truck.
If you've got one left.
You don't like the idea?
I like the money.
A Mitchy Farm doesn't make a good driver. Needs guts, confidence. You don't inspire me.
You're looking for a sucker, aren't you, Mr. Cartley?
So that's basically the setup of the story, and it's a bloody good one, too. The film's in black and white. The cinematographer is... There's nobody better, really. It's Jeffrey Unsworth. You might not recognise the name, but how's this for a list of movies he's the cinematographer on? I'll just go from the top down to the bottom and pick out the high points. The Million Pound Note in 1953, A Town Like Alice, A Night to Remember, The 300 Spartans, Beckett, 2001 A Space Odyssey, Zardoz, Royal Flash, The Return of the Pink Panther, A Bridge Too Far, and 3 Superman movies. So this guy is fantastic. And the camera work in this film is extraordinary. There is some over-cranking on some of the truck scenes when they're ripping around these country roads, but I don't think it suffers for that. You can still see by the way they're tossing these enormous trucks around that... the drivers are incredibly skilled. There's one scene where a guy rips around a corner with a full load of gravel and the truck almost tips and a whole lot of the gravel just pours off onto the road. It's a very visceral thing, and the ensemble cast of the film is kind of extraordinary. I'll give you a list. I've touched on it before there, but I'll give you a fuller list. Stanley Baker, fantastic Welsh actor. He was knighted just towards the end of his life. And he did 6 movies with Cy Endfield, including Sands of the Kalahari, which I did on a previous podcast. That was the last of the 6 collaborations between these two guys. They got on really well, and Stanley Baker's a good, solid character actor. Herbert Lom, of course, some people know him from playing the comic stooge to Peter Sellers in the Pink Panther movies. But in this film, he plays an Italian called Gino Rossi. It's a little bit of a stage Italian kind of thing. It doesn't sound a lot like real Italians in a sense, but he brings the humanity of the character across quite well. Peggy Cummins is in the film. She was the love interest and the female lead in Night of the Demon. So both of these movies have a link to Night of the Demon, the Jacques Tourneur movie. Patrick McGoohan playing Red, the foreman of the truckers, and he is a total psychopath. I mean, McGoohan brings his usual intensity to this role, kind of ramped up. He's a brutal thug, basically, and quite full of himself. As I said, William Hartnell's in it, the guy who played the first Doctor Who. There's a nice little piece with a character called Ed, who's the mechanic, and who takes Tom out for a test drive before he gets the job. He's played by an actor called Wilfred Lawson, who sits in the passenger seat of the truck in a little bowler hat, and he's got a small mustache. And there's quite a slightly comic scene with the Ed character as he's showing Tom how to use a truck. It's fairly obvious that he's never driven a truck like this before, and Ed basically coaches him through how to handle a truck, doing these arduous 10-mile runs to the quarry and back. Sid James is in this. Sid James from the Carry On movies, playing another one of the truck drivers. Jill Ireland's in the film. It's one of her first movies as well. In fact, her ex-husband David McCallum's in the film. They met in this movie and married soon after. David McCallum's in it, playing Jimmy Yately, Tom's younger brother, who's a cripple in a sense. He's on crutches. It doesn't actually state what the problem is, but there are a few scenes there, and there's a nice rapport between Stanley Baker and David McCallum. They get on quite well together. It's a nice touch there, and it fleshes out Tom's character and his motivations quite nicely. Alfie Bass, an English character actor, is in this one, playing another truck driver. Gordon Jackson, the Scottish actor who's been in tons of things, The Professionals. He's in there as another one of the drivers. Sean Connery's in there in a minor role. He's not even on the first screen of the credit rolls, but he's there. It's the second film for Connery. He plays a character called Johnny Cates, one of the truckers there, and he brings a really nice intensity to it. And it's interesting seeing Sean Connery this young. But, so basically you've got a whole bunch of really tough characters, and all the truckers are competitive because there's a $250 22-carat gold cigarette case for anybody who can beat Red's record on the truck. So all of these truck drivers are competitive and boisterous and brawling kind of guys. And having that kind of an ensemble cast of genuinely tough actors really kind of brings the kind of working-class toughness to it. Now, Seinfeld's actually spoken about the making of this film and what he really wanted to bring to Hell Drivers. Okay, Enfield stated that there's plenty of natural drama in the everyday jobs of men with physical contact with reality. With the survival jobs, the basic jobs, the contact with reality is reduced to simple, basic terms. And that is essentially cinematic. And that's why he did this. He was a little bit of a socialist in a way. He, as I said, he was kind of driven to go to the UK by the House Un-American Activities Committee, and all through his career he's had a theme. If there is a theme running through the movies of Cy Enfield, it's the lives of men doing tough jobs. And his cinematic career is fairly impressive. He did this film, Hell Drivers. He did another film that I haven't been able to find with Stanley Baker called Sea Fury. It's about tugboat seamen in action. I shouldn't say seaman like that, it sounds wrong. He did Zulu, which is one of the great films. Sands of the Kalahari, I've already spoken about that. And, and he's one of those kind of almost forgotten and unsung film directors. He is also a producer, but really good, solid stuff. He didn't do anything really to surpass the success of Zulu, but I do like Enfield's films, and I do like the fact that he showed us parts of England which we don't normally see. And one of the ways that Enfield enhances the reality in this film is there's a lot of when they go to the truck stop cafe where the guys eat at night, there are genuine advertising signs. They're not the kind of made up fake company signs that you see in a lot of films. They're genuine products and things like that. There's a billboard across the road from the entrance to the trucking company, which sells Smarties and things like that, and advertises things. So there are genuine advertising hoardings around. The truck depot itself isn't actually a real truck depot. It was built on Pinewood Studios lot on the site that is now, funnily enough, where the 007 stage is. So Sean Connery worked on the physical location of the 007 stage 5 years before Dr. No came out, which is slightly interesting. But this film, Enfield tried to make it as real as possible as he could with what he had to work with. Yes, it was a fairly low budget film. It was black and white. It was being done on the hop, but he put together such an incredible ensemble of actors just to tell this fairly simple story about competitive truck drivers. And ultimately, Red, the character played by Patrick McGoohan, and Tom go head-to-head to try to beat Red's record of 18 hauls a day. And as that occurs, the Peggy Cummins character reveals some of the background to why these truckers have to basically get as many loads as possible. There are reasons why this kind of brutal Darwinian nightmare of a job happens the way it is. And that of course leads to the climax of the film, which is pretty cool. Again, you watch the cinematography. There's a nice depth of focus that Unsworth brings to the film, and even within the limitations that he had to work with there. And it's nice seeing all these character actors and these actors who became famous years later. David McCallum, of course, in The Man from U.N.C.L.E., Sean Connery, Sid James in the Caparion movies, Patrick McGoohan in The Prisoner and things like that. Stanley Baker had a distinguished career well into the 1970s. My favourite Stanley Baker film is a film he did in 1997. It's called Innocent Bystanders, a spy movie. I've got to try to locate a copy of Innocent Bystanders. It's based on a good spy novel by a guy called James Munro. And I do like it a lot. I may try to do it for a podcast if I can find a decent enough copy to watch. It's not anything that's out on DVD yet, but I saw it in the cinemas back in my misspent youth. And Baker was older then, but he does really bring across a reality to what he does that I find really interesting. Basically, Stanley Baker almost went into the coal mines in Wales, but that was saved by going onto the stage. And Hell Drivers, by the way, is available on DVD. There was a British release 3 years ago, and it should still be available on Amazon.co.uk. And also, it's just got an Australian release, Mad Men Entertainment. If you Google Mad Men Entertainment, you'll be able to find a copy of it there. And it's a very nice release. It's not a bare bones release at all. They do have a TV, kind of half an hour TV show they did on the making of Hell Drivers, where they interview Stanley Baker and Alfie Bass, and they show some location shots they took to Cy Enfield, the director, about the film as well. And that's an inclusion on there. And there's also a kind of mini TV documentary where Stanley Baker is interviewed by a TV guy in the late 50s talking about his career and about how he became an actor and things like that. So there are those inclusions for this, which I kind of like, because this isn't a big film. This isn't a film that won awards or anything like that, but it's one of those films that people who know movies regard highly. I remember talking about this film years ago with a guy I know called Justin Aykroyd, who's he runs a bookshop, and Justin loves this film. He likes the kind of vitality of it, the fact that it's rough as guts, and all of these incredibly now famous actors are in this film just kind of bashing against each other. In fact, there is a fight scene between Patrick McGoohan and Stanley Baker in the film. And McGoohan used to be a boxer, and Stanley Baker is a pretty tough guy himself. And they actually hurt each other in this fight. You know, there was real blood and lots of bruising going on there. So just to make the give that film that verisimilitude, that sense of reality, they actually did duff each other up somewhat while they were making the movie, which doesn't happen these days. And, of course, we all know actors that we'd love to see punched. Anyway, that's about it for Hell Drivers. Do get a copy of it if you possibly can. As I said, it is available in Australia, and it's worth being a part of your collection. It's just one of those great, small-budget, intense British dramas that that you can share with friends too. You can show people that, you know, what Sean Connery looked like before James Bond, and just get them. And the story, even from the start, is very, very involving. The title sequence is filmed from the front bumper of one of the trucks as it careers around these quite small and dodgy country roads. And it's not an incredibly well-known film, but it is really a worthwhile way to spend time. So that's it for that. Do see the film. Very, very cool, very good, and not shabby at all. I'm going to take another break now and come back with the feedback and wrap this puppy up. Before I do, I've just checked my calendar and I'm due to do another podcast on the 25th of December. I'm going to get that one in early. I'm going to squeeze that one in. I've got a couple of ideas for what I want to do. So if you do want to offer feedback on the next podcast, please get it in before the reindeer shit hits your roof. And it'll be included in the next one. So as I said, I'm going to take a break and I'll get back and get back into the feedback. That was the theme track to the 2009 movie OSS 117 Rio Ne Repond Plus, which is the latest of the OSS 117 movies with Jean Dujardin in it. Very kind of groovy 60s sounds, but it was actually made in 2009. Anyway, on to the feedback. I've got the first voicemail here, and let's get on with it.
Hey, this is Richard in Wichita. Just wanted to call in. Your comments at the end of episode 63, Terry, were just... they were phenomenal. They were great and really tied in with a message that I left to the B-Movie cast earlier today. I don't want to rehash that message, but essentially I was kind of doing an off-the-wall voicemail, and I just wanted to kind of give a virtual thank you to my father, who really played a key part in my lifetime love of horror and sci-fi and fantasy movies specifically. In my voicemail to the guys at the B-Movie cast, you know, I spent the weekend with my dad, and my dad is 79. Personal realization that my dad's getting older, my time with him is limited, but he is still very active in many ways for his age, and a lot of my lifetime memories, you know, in shows and in movies that I've watched, he was right there with me. Just in the last couple of years, you know, at the age of 77, my dad had come up to, they live about 3 hours away from me. They came up to visit, and we watched the new Star Trek film together, went to the movie theater. First time since 1989 that we had been able to get away, just he and I, to watch a movie in a movie theater. And he loved it. The last 2 years, my dad has come with me to Trek Expo. It's a science fiction convention down in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And, you know, I just, you know, your comments on the whole, you know, podcasting community and We're not really, we don't know what the future lies. We're not going to go away. You know, the whole medium may change. But for me, I think the last, how many ever years now, I guess maybe 4 years that I've been listening to podcasts have been awesome for me, because it's allowed me to make some connections to other people with same interests of me as me. For example, I'm a big Doctor Who fan, and I've been able to connect with people who are also Doctor Who fans. You know, I hadn't really talked to anybody since the 1980s that really liked Doctor Who, you know, but here I was in the last 4 years or so being able to connect with people because of this love for this, you know, quirky little, you know, British sci-fi series. I've been able to connect with people on films through the podcast. And, you know, I've left voicemail. People have, you know, commented on my voicemails. We've connected via Facebook, trading movies with a lot of these great people here in the States. A lot of it was kind of started in the last year or so. I became in possession of a 1965 film called The Beast from the Beginning of Time, filmed here in Wichita. It was never released. It is just as good as any low-budget horror film from the 60s. It really should be given a proper DVD release. It took me decades to get a copy of it. When I did, I was, I've shared it with a handful of select people. But, you know, just to give you an example of this great community that's been started because of podcasts and because of everyone's love of movies, one of the listeners over at the B-Movie Cast, had gone through his personal collection and just out of the blue just sent me a box of DVDs and said, you know, here you go. Keep what you don't have. And, if you have something in the collection, you know, forward it on to someone else. And it was a pleasant surprise. I mean, actually, that's really an understatement. When I opened up the box and saw some of the fantastic movies that were in this box that I did not have in my collection, that had long been on my wish list. I'm talking about movies like Seven Samurai, Yojimbo. I mean, that's the quality of films we're talking about here. It was awesome, and it was because of podcasting. So, you know, I loved your comments at the end of episode 63. I think we've just got an awesome community going with all of us here. You know, and the fact that I'm leaving a voicemail to your show and you're all the way in Australia, that's a connection that, you know, a few years ago really wouldn't have been able to have. So with that, loving each and every episode. I really don't have any specific comments on episode 63, other than, you know, specifically Thunder Road is an awesome movie. Been a long time since I've seen it. It's when you do suggestions like that, you know, oftentimes I discover new films or rediscover films that I haven't seen for a while. So, loving the show, loved your comments, and as always, take care, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for that, Richard. Yeah, the feedback is fantastic. I always enjoyed getting it. I always enjoy being a part of the feedback to other podcasts when I get off my ass and actually go and give in to other podcasts. But, It's great to have that that camaraderie, and the fact that we're networking globally is a new phenomenon, and it does blow me away, because I do look at the geo map of where my audience is, and I've got North and South America, I've got Europe, Asia, sometimes Africa. Basically, I haven't got Antarctica yet. It's the only continent that my voice hasn't been to, which is a freaky thought. Here I am sitting facing the window in the library at home, and reaching out and engaging the interests of people all across the planet is pretty fucking wonderful. And I'm never going to underestimate that sense of wonder that I have about that. It really is an important part of me enjoying what I'm doing here. I do have a second voicemail from one of our usual suspects here, the wonderful and idiosyncratic Dr. Zom.
Monsieur Frost, this is Dr. Zom. I am calling from the highest peak of the Eiffel Tower in France. calling to speak to you about the movie The Gremlin Letter. The Gremlin Letter. I have wanted to see this movie for such a long time, but I cannot find it. Can I find it anywhere? I have read about this movie in the book about the movies of the Kirk Douglas, but I cannot find. I must find the Gremlin Letter. I must see it, absorb it. I must listen to your review. But when I finally do find it, I fear for my life. I fear for my life that I will take the nail and stab it into my chin so as to look like the manly man, and that is a Kirk Douglas. How can I ever live up to his reputation? I cannot. The machismo that flows through the Kirk, it flows through my loins. I must find it. I must find the Kirk. Bells will ring, ring-a-ling-a-ling, 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 Montebella. How do you say, dippy-dippy-day, 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 Kirk Douglas.
Thank you very much, Sam. I've got three things to say about what you said. One, send me a Facebook message. We'll get you the Gremlin Letter. No problem at all. Two, and I mean this with great love and affection, Kirk Douglas wasn't in the movie. I'm not going to go any further than that. And three, the French accent was fantastic, but there were times, and this is not a negative, when it sounded a lot like Michael Parks playing the 80-year-old Mexican pimp in the second Kill Bill movie. Had a little bit of that in it there, so that's a groovy thing in itself. When you do those accents, they always kind of phase into something different from a movie, and it's part of the general wonderfulness of what you do, mate. So that's it for the podcast. It's slightly shorter than previous ones have been, but we'll get back on track next time around. Do Hell Drivers with an S on the end. And if you can find the Gremlin Letter, do a little bit of a search. If you do a rapid search, or maybe a torrent search, you may be able to find it if you can't find it on DVD. But it's very well worthwhile, and it is one of those movies that when you're watching it, it's not one of those ones you can watch in the background. You do have to pay attention to get full value and to follow the plot and to see what a number of the characters are actually doing. Anyway, that's about it. I will get one more in before the reindeer shit on the roof. And take care of yourselves. Really have fun. Oh, that's the other thing I'm going to do. I do have to do shout-outs to podcasts. First one is The Writer and the Critic, who my friends Kirsten and Ian do. It's about science fiction and genre films, genre books. And apparently I inspired at least Mondi to start a podcast about the stuff he's passionate about. Check that one out. There is a link on the Paleo Cinema website. I do have to do, of course, a shout out to the GGTMC. They've been wonderfully supportive. They've been fantastic and they do good stuff. So all of the people involved in that. Mail Order Zombie, of course, with Brother D and Miss Bren. Always good. I listened to 150th episode and it was a groovy thing indeed. Of course, the people over at the B-Movie Cast always love what you do and the way that you do it. And I'm probably going to forget a number of podcasts. I hear from Ben that Cine Coltania may be coming back. I do want to catch up with him soon. We're actually going to do some FaceTime at some stage, but I want to encourage him to do that if it is within what he's capable of doing or what he wants to do. And it's nice to have another movie podcast in Melbourne. You can never have too many movie podcasts. And also to all the audience, I hope if you're in the Northern Hemisphere that you're keeping your feet dry and staying warm. And if you're down here, that you don't get too much sunburn. So that's about it. Please feedback to the usual things. And if you can get it in a little bit earlier this time, I'll be able to incorporate it into the one I do just before the 25th. I had a couple of ideas for the movies I'm going to do, but one of the things I'm sure I'm going to do is the last three podcasts have had movies about vehicles in them, so I'm going to try to avoid vehicles just for one podcast. Anyway, that's it. Take care, and I'll catch you soon.